Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inform. I'm John Wildermuth, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Tonight, we're discussing how to move the state of California forward. We've gathered an exciting group of experts to tell us what California needs to do to become more efficient, more effective, and more responsible. We have Gabriel Metcalf, Executive Director, San Francisco Planning and Urban Research Association, better known as SPUR. Jaime Rossi, President of Barbary Coast Consulting. Melissa Griffin, a political blogger, Sweet Melissa, co-host of Necessary Conversation and a contributor to the San Francisco Examiner. And Lenny Mendonca, Director of McKinsey & Company and a member of the Leadership Council for California Forward. Now's our chance to actually meet him, and we can get started. Start with a question for everybody to take a look at. And the question is pretty basic. It's, what is reform when we talk about it? One person's reform is another person's disaster. I mean, if you talk about, for example, ranked choice voting in San Francisco, some people say it's reform, others don't. You talk about term limits, same thing. Just about anything that's up there, somebody's in favor and somebody's against. So how do we decide what's reform? And why don't we start out with Lenny?
Thanks, John. So to me, at least in California, the core issues that need to be dealt with when in reform are about how we actually govern ourselves and how our budgeting process works. Without getting those things straight, we're not going to be able to deal with any of the more fundamental issues in the policy arena, whether that's education or prisons or healthcare delivery. And until we actually have a process by which we have a rational discussion and a real set of trade-offs that are made about what do we want in our budget, that there's accountability associated with that, that we think about longer-term budgeting, not just near-term, and that as part of that we have the necessary accountability that comes with that, and then that we have over time alignment around where the money comes in and where it goes and clarity around that, I don't think we're going to get much else done. So at the top of California Forward's list, at least, are budget and fiscal reform, at least as at the first level of things that need to have to get fixed.
Jaime?
I think even to go a little bit deeper on that, I think to really truly reform the state, we have to reform the way we do direct democracy and the initiative system. I think we have a system in California, frankly, where voters vote on any number of measures, either at the local or state level, with very little knowledge about what the consequences of that policy that they're voting on. The two that you mentioned, the ranked choice voting and I forgot what the other one
was. Term limits.
Term limits. They were both brought in through the initiative process. And frankly, there's a lot of limitations on putting stuff in front of the voters. We all talk about Prop 13. We talk about Prop 8. We talk about any number of initiatives that have come down the pike. And I think that the state has gotten itself into this big mess because we legislators don't have the responsibility anymore to legislate. It's left up to this system of initiatives. And, frankly, I think that's the most broken piece of California.
Your turn, Melissa.
Well, I think your question was, what is reform and who decides? And what is reform? It's structural change to the political process in response to a problem. Now, as you point out, reform is, one person's reform is the other person's damnable meddling in the process. And in terms of who decides, obviously bloggers should decide.
I was thinking newspaper reporters.
those two. They're on the internet. There are two things I think required to sort of galvanize people to reform. One is a real political will. And that is something that I think we're getting closer to by, I think the fact that we're having this conversation right now indicates people understand the system is broken. They understand that there are structural problems that we need to overcome, and they want to think about them, they want to talk about them. So the first thing is to sort of have this sort of coalescing of political will. The other thing that needs to happen is there needs to be a set of proposals from an organization like California Forward or from the Bay Area Council or from any number of organizations who have people on staff who are you know, paid nerds who look at these things and can come up with rational proposals for voters to think about. I think if you put things to them in a way that makes sense to them, that they will vote in favor of certain reforms. So, you know, what is reform? You know, that's a theoretical question. But in order to get there, I think we've got, you know, two of the things that are happening, which, again, is people's immense dissatisfaction with what's happening now, and also a number of proposals from organizations. And whichever one of those rises to the top is what ends up being reform. Although I did read once the definition of political reform in California is what voters do to break our own hearts. So let's hope we can continue to improve the situation here.
Gabriel?
Starting from your observation that one person's reform is, you know, another person's travesty, that's just true, right? That's a truth about the human condition, and it's a truth about our society. We don't all agree with each other about what should happen, and it's true that what one person thinks makes the world better, another person thinks makes the world worse, and nobody's trying to make the world worse, but somehow it's happening anyway. I conclude from that, there's no really good way out of that paradox, except the only one I know is I fall back on majority rule that we've got to sort of propose solutions, make the case in the court of public opinion like we're doing tonight, and try to convince a majority of people. And I really don't know a better answer than that. So to me, the things I see that are really perverting the ideal of majority rule are where you would start. And that's things like a one-third minority of voters can prevent the rest of us from voting to tax ourselves for public services. I mean, I think those kind of things that are clearly violating the principle of a majority of citizens governing themselves in a democracy are where you would have to start for the fundamental reforms of our system.
Thanks. Jamie, when you talked about initiatives and changing mm-hmm. that system, one of the problems with that has always been that just about every poll I see says that people don't want anybody messing with their initiatives. They like the chance of getting out there and being able to vote on stuff. So what sort of changes could be made that still give them that chance, still keep the initiative process viable, but maybe improve it?
You know, it's interesting because I think that we think of ourselves as a state as being, you know, and I think we are, you know, extremely forward-thinking, avant-garde, but frankly, the initiative system is pretty rigid. You know, at the end of the day, you know, someone with a lot of money puts something on the ballot that you get professional vote getters or paid nerds to come and collect signatures. And then once it's on there and it gets voted 50 plus one, the opportunity to change it just isn't there. So I would think one of the best things that you could do to actually change it is to have some kind of language or some kind of amendment to the system that would allow the legislature to modify it or change it maybe after a few years, maybe have it sit for a year before it actually goes into effect. But right now I think that, you know, the way the system works, once it's done, it's done, and there's no turning back unless you go put it out in front of the voters one more time.
Lenny, there was last year, or I guess the year before, whenever, there was a lot of talk about a constitutional convention. And a lot of the reform groups in California thought it was a great idea. And there was a move to start putting the stuff together and actually getting something on the ballot. And it fell apart at the end because there was nobody that would come up with the money to actually get that done. How do you get around that? The fact that you can have the greatest idea in the world in California, but unless you have the money, it's never going to make the ballot.
So the one of the challenges of the initiative process that Jaime just mentioned is that there's a relatively short time period for something to qualify for the ballot if it's done by signatures. And to be able to get the signatures at scale that you need, it's almost impossible to do that without paying signature gatherers. And so that process in and of itself, particularly when the signature gathering is an oligopoly by a few entities who like that position, is actually not the way to have citizen engagement in the initiative process. And citizens do want initiatives to be part of the process. So as you said, if you poll any of that, there is actually no appetite to eliminate the initiative process. But I think there are ways, like Jaime mentioned, to help make it better. And among those ways would be to have anything that's proposed on the ballot actually has to be paid for in the same approach, so that have PAYGO for initiatives and PAYGO for anything that's approved through the legislature. Are there other ways to adapt it, including trying to ensure that there's legislative overview or sunsetting on initiatives? I think those kinds of things are possibilities. Personally, I would think differently about the role of signature gatherers, including extreme disclosure on who's funding the signature gathering, not just the proposals itself. And the convention was got the conversation about citizens could be engaged in reform on the agenda, whether it happened in the first time or not. Simply speaking, the clock ran out and the money ran out before the signatures could gather. That doesn't mean it wasn't a good possibility or won't happen again. It just meant at that particular avenue it didn't happen.
Any other ideas about the way that the initiative process should be changed, Melissa and Gabe?
As you guys both pointed out, there are certain ways that other jurisdictions actually have the initiative process. California is the only state of like 25 or 26 states who has the initiative process that also limits anything that's enacted by initiative can only be unenacted by initiative or amended by voter initiative as well. Other places allow for the legislature, for example, later to go back in and after a period of time amend that initiative. Notably, we also do that in San Francisco. In San Francisco, Supervisor Scott Wiener has also proposed something similar for the next ballot that comes up, whenever that is, probably November, to have something on there that would also allow us citywide to be able to go back in and change some legislation that was put on the city charter. Or by initiative as well. So those sorts of things can be done because the public gets sick of it, because then the initiative comes back to us when someone wants to amend it, and we go, do your jobs, people in Sacramento. But the truth is that they don't really have a choice. And so it just creates more and more voter frustration and more voter alienation from the legislative process, which is why we want to keep our initiatives in the first place. So
we talked about this in the room before coming out here on stage, and we all agreed this one change to the initiative process would fix at least half the problems. It'd be a really, and I suspect we could get it passed, but easy for me to say because Lenny would have to raise the money.
When you talk about one thing you hear a lot from voters is they look at the ballot and they say, what are we paying our legislators for? A lot of the stuff that shows up on the ballot, things like, for example, in the last ballot, the idea of changing the of changing the way that we draw the district lines, the idea of changing to from a two-thirds requirement for a budget. Why is this stuff showing up? Why do we have to vote on this stuff, and why isn't it being handled in Sacramento or in the San Francisco Board of Supervisors? Start with you, Melissa.
I think so much of what's the source of the problem that we have in California, both what's leading our intractable grip on the initiative process and what keeps us from giving local government the power to tax, and what keeps us wanting to limit the state government and their ability to tax, is this horrible mistrust. And by horrible, I don't mean it's a bad thing. I just mean it's horrible in the sense that it's intense hatred. And alienation from our legislators. Most people that you talk to on the street will tell you that they're a pack of idiots, and we don't want them to have the power to tax us. We want to really rein in their ability to do anything that affects our lives because we don't trust them. And so on the one hand, we don't trust them. On the other hand, we get a ballot, for example, like the one you point out, where we look at it as voters and say, I'm going to vote no on everything just because I hate them. I'm going to show them what I think of them and what I think of their stupid ballot measures by voting no on everything, except for the 1F, which was limiting legislative pay. So voters send very clear messages, in our own particular ways. So, what do we do about this issue of alienation from our representatives? Ideally, whatever we do about that, I think sort of trickles down and will affect these other areas of taxation and the initiative process sort of in general.
I also think that term limits have severely changed the way that legislators do their jobs. And, you don't have the Willie Browns in there for such a long time that you build these long-term relationships. You learn how to get something through the legislature. And when you have people who are only there for 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, the ability to actually build a coalition, make friends, get something done, have relationships across the aisle just isn't there. And I think what happens is that, frankly, a lot of legislators, because they're not there long enough, lack the political courage to really go forward. And I think one of the things when Jerry Brown came back to being governor, I mean, I know myself personally, it was almost a breath of fresh air because it was like, wow, there's a guy who's been there before. There's a guy who kind of knows what he's doing. Now, obviously, he's got a big fight and he hasn't been able to get everything done that he's wanted to get done. But there's something to be said for political maturity.
Again, you know, I hate to do this, but to go back to the polls, every time, you know, people recognize, say, well, term limits, it's a problem up in Sacramento. But it seems to only be a problem among the people in Sacramento, a very, very inside baseball type problem. Because if you ask voters, well, heck, we voted it in the first time, and we don't really want to change it. How do you get past that? Or should you get past it? Lenny, what about you?
So I agree term limits have made this worse. I also agree that it's true that if you ask citizens, do you like term limits, they say yes. It's also one of those things that has unintended second consequences that if you actually have a real discussion about it and say, how can we adapt this so that there is competition and openness in the opportunity so that you don't have someone in an uncontested seat forever, so you may have a different kind of term limit, but that we don't have a situation where there's constantly people rotating, looking through their next office with no experience. I think if you had a real thoughtful discussion with citizens about that, they would come to a different solution. Part of the challenge with the initiative process and campaigns that are around those is they are articulated and campaigned in sound bites that sound great, but they don't actually talk about really what are the consequences. So, the term limits were really a first reaction to too much power for Willie Brown. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had all kinds of appeal at that point because people felt like there was too much going on, and now we're living with the consequences 2 decades later and can't seem to do anything about it.
Melissa, have term limits had any effect in San Francisco?
Well, you know, they're relatively new. So, you know, I don't know if we've seen the full extent of what the effect is going to be in San Francisco over time. Locally it's a little bit, you know, a little bit different. You'd have the same players, for better or worse, for years and years at a time. And there are relationships, and there are people willing to take risks. For better or for worse. I will say, though, one of the problems with term limits, and one of the problems about any of these issues as we isolate them, term limits, initiative process, taxation, the problem is that they sort of create this jumbled mess. And the reason voters, when you tell them, you know, what do you think about term limits, and they say we hate politicians and let's keep them there for a limited amount of time, it's because no one has yet successfully been able to tie term limits to a specific problem. Again, because sort of the issues are so gray and sort of again messy, that if you could show voters the reason why your pothole isn't filled is because of term limits. I know, yeah. But if there was some way to make it clear what the problem is and that this would be a solution, then I think that that's something that they would go for. But again, term limits affect the initiative process, which affects, which affects taxation, which affects people who run for office. You know, so it becomes harder and harder to convince people that this solution is going to, affect this problem. And that's one of the reasons why I think, you know, term limits, people go, yeah, it sounds right.
Gabriel?
Well, we're all discussing this problem of voters and citizens not necessarily always understanding the full implications of the choices we face, right? And if any of you ever hear, I don't know, one of those sort of standard anti-war speeches where they say at the end, and they're using your tax dollars to pay for that war, you will sometimes hear somebody pipe up and say, why doesn't the government use its own money? And the kind of profound alienation that Americans have from their own democracy is, you know, you just don't want to know what people think they're voting on, and all of the kind of focus groups on that are really scary. So the solutions are, I don't know, more members of the Commonwealth Club. I think another solution is, there's this, I think to bring up something Lenny was talking about earlier, some more experimentation with deliberative democracy instead of direct democracy. Deliberative democracy being where you give people a chance to actually talk about things. There are models that have been used in other places of a kind of jury system where you get randomly picked the way you do for a jury, and then you get assigned with a group of people to work on a problem over the course of a year, and you come back with some recommendations. And those have often been, even if the recommendations are just delivered to the legislature, they often have a lot of political momentum behind them because regular people figured them out. And instead of this kind of off the top of your head, yes or no experience you have in the voting booth, a deliberative democratic process gives ordinary citizens the chance to get informed and get their minds changed through discussion and debate. I think we could stand to try that out in California.
That sounds a lot like the the civil grand jury process that most counties already have,
which are not randomly selected.
But even so, the biggest problem that I found with the civil grand juries is they spend a year, they do their report, they hand it to the Board of Supervisors, which says, thanks a lot for your time and your report, and then throws it over their shoulder, and that's the last anybody hears about it. How do you have a process like that and that doesn't turn into just people talking to each other and nothing happening at the end?
Well, we can really learn from other places that have done this at scale, but one thing is you need to really have a random selection so any citizen has an equal chance of getting on it. That gives it more legitimacy. The second thing is you have to staff the process and really provide information and background, and both of those don't exist in a civil grand jury.
Yeah, go ahead,
add two other things to that. One is that juries don't have random either selection at the beginning or discussion in a way where your vote is private. They're actually convening, and then it has to be a majority, and they're all public in that setting about what your vote is. So you don't necessarily get independent opinions. Properly designed deliberations have those elements of them. The second thing I'd say is I completely agree there's enormous potential here to experiment where we should be defining that frontier. But ironically, if you go back to the origins of representative democracy, that is how issues were selected and deliberated in Athens. Before the republics voted, the elected representatives voted, a random group of citizens got together, selected by lot, in a machine that's still out there that looks like a bingo machine, that they were selected to deliberate on what did they think that their representatives should discuss. And so in some ways,
we could
the
all wear togas while doing
to,
it. It would be so fun, you guys.
Exactly. Actually, I would just point out the obvious. So, you know, they didn't have television back in Athens. I don't know. I got to be honest. I know very few people who would be excited to be, you know, to get that letter in the mail saying, congratulations, you've been picked to talk about California politics for a week and come up with some recommendations.
Au contraire.
That we may or may not. No, I would love that because I'm a dork. I would love that.
But regular people, I
don't know. I know some civilians, and I don't think that any of them would be too thrilled at that prospect, especially since whatever hard work, whatever their hard work results in, it may or may not be at all used. And again, it may have, if they come up with something that's really fabulous, it might have some sort of gravity that say, you know, PG&E putting something on the ballot does not. But at the same time, I think this notion of juries, deliberating, as much as I would love it, is not really realistic.
I think the experience with citizens applying for the redistricting office of the commission shows that that's not true. People are actually really interested in it if there's consequences. That was a group of people that you had to put a lot of energy in to even be considered for that, and it was a substantial commitment of time. And there were thousands of people across the state who would be prepared to do that. I'm not sure that they're any likely to do any worse than the current system that we have, so I'd be willing to try a little bit of that and see what happens. If there's no interest, there's no outcome, what's the worst thing we lost? We got a bunch of people to get engaged in issues, and I think that would be constructive in and of itself.
Well, that begs a very important question, is how do you get people involved in the first place? I mean, it's really great to talk about reforms and everything like that, but how do you get the momentum behind a reform, get people, and especially in California, young people, to realize that this is their problem and that they have to do something about it? If you look at the way at the voting records, they haven't been going so hot. Fewer and fewer people register. Fewer and fewer people actually show up to vote. How do you light the fire under the grassroots of California? And just start with you, Jamie.
I mean, I think it all, frankly, people are most involved when they, the closer they are to the issue. And it really all starts with local issue or neighborhood issue or something that impacts them directly. I mean, frankly, I mean, Melissa's right to a certain extent. I mean, most people, you know, you talk about the California budget and they glaze over. I mean, it doesn't really matter the political debate or the substantive debate. They know there's issues, they know there's problems, but frankly, most of them just know the problems as I hate my legislators and this state is broke. And that's about the extent of it. But I think that when you get more local, I mean, if you want to get young people involved, then you should be talking about schools and jobs and things that interest them, things that they know are A, B, and C in terms of their livelihood. You know, if you want to get people involved in, I mean, San Francisco, for instance, if anything, it's too involved. I mean, I deal on, you know, we have clients who have to go through the San Francisco political system, and then the number of checks and balances and hurdles that folks have to get through because it's a system with a lot of participation. And sometimes that hyper-democracy, on some level, has its own challenges.
Lenny, you've got California Forward has a whole bunch of reforms that they'd like to move toward and everything. Again, getting the list is the easy part. Moving people behind that list and getting that stuff through is a lot harder. How do you do it?
I thought you were going to tell me the answer to that question. So
all these people will after we get done here.
Well, first of all, I think it is the hardest part of this equation. If we're going to actually have the reforms happen, we have to have engagement because it's easy to stop something in this state. If anybody doesn't want something on a ballot proposition, all you have to do is put a bunch of money up against it and it'll lose. It's really hard to make positive change happen, particularly in the public interest. And the only way that changes is with creating a movement for change. I'll give you a concern about that and then at least one way I think we might be able to do something about it. The concern is people are being rational. You know, you look at the system and say, so why should I get involved? How am I going to make any difference if I have one random voter, one person? And in a state this big with that complicated a set of issues that we've all been talking about, it's perfectly rational for people to say, I'll just sit this one out and let somebody else do it. And if they really care, they'll put it on the ballot and I'll vote no. So, you know, it's not an irrational decision on an individual basis. I think what we have to do, though, is help spark the revolution that helps people understand that if you don't get engaged, that's what happens. You know, look at your, if you don't like what's going on in your schools, if you don't like what your taxes are, if you don't like how the prisons are working, you know, it didn't take much of a spark to get stuff going in a few weeks in Tunisia or Egypt. I'm not sure it's impossible to connect that spark in places like this. And I think it's partly about having more conversations at this type that are scaled with people who are engaged already and interested. But really, it's about getting average citizens involved. I think there's possibilities that particularly with today's social media technology and mobile technology, that if the right application's there and the right opportunity to get engaged, I think we could spark it. Have we done it yet? Do people know how to do it? No. I think what it's going to take is a lot of experimentation and see what works, and when we get something, we help enable it. I will tell you, in the Constitutional Convention drive, despite the fact that we ran out of time to raise the money to put it on the ballot, there was interest. There was an enormous sparking because people could see, wow, we could actually convene something and take over the state. So I think it's about sparking that interest to get people engaged again.
Gabriel, in California, in San Francisco, there really hasn't been any problem getting people involved in urban issues. I mean, again, there are a lot of people that have a lot of things they want to say about this. How does a group like yours get people behind stuff or tell them or say this is important and people should be concerned?
Well, it is the great thing about San Francisco. People are here on purpose, not on accident. And it's a great city. And we a lot of people come here to be political, and that's our hobby. It's like sports or something in other cities. Is we pay attention to local politics. So I think you know, people do have the right to tune out from politics and just live their lives if they want, and that's okay. But I do think it's a great thing about San Francisco that I think we all can be proud of, is it's a really politically engaged place. So, you know, at Spur, we we have a set of things we're trying to get done. We're trying to stop sprawl and channel growth back into the city. We're trying to make transit work better. We're working on a lot of public infrastructure issues. And what I find is that people in San Francisco kind of get it and kind of believe and agree that all of those things are important.
Do you see, you're a blogger, and do you have any problem getting people to, talk back about something you have there or issues in San Francisco?
Oh, no. We're a vocal and engaged bunch. But to your question about, you know, what do we do to get young people engaged in particular, my first response is sort of, do it in 140 characters or less. That's how you get, can you get your message out that quickly? But there are two things that have to happen, and I think that it goes for young people in California, and it goes sort of anywhere. Number one, people have to think that there's a problem. And people already are kind of there. As you point out, Lenny, that the ConCon had a lot of interest. There were polls, I think it was like February of 2009. Polling came out, said that most people really supported this idea of a constitutional convention. They get that there's a problem, a structural problem, not a content problem, just generally the way the process that we have in place in California is messed up. Now, not everyone agreed on sort of how, what to do about it, but at least we're there. And I think as things keep going, frankly, if nothing happens, it's going to be too big to ignore. And once people really get, I cannot graduate from college in 4 years because my schools have been cut so badly that I can't get the credits and the education that I need to graduate in 4 years. Then they will, they will do this on their own to some degree. So number one, you have to make sure that the people understand that there's a need. The other part of the equation is that people have to understand that there's something they can do about it, that this action is actually going to have a result. So sometimes you have very motivated people, but they're relegated to doing what? To voting. Okay. Well, that's great. But there needs to be something more. And so the identification of the problem and the solution is just critical to convincing anyone, old, young, Californian, San Franciscan, that this is the reform that we need to engage in.
But remember, citizens in California have gotten engaged occasionally very quickly to do something. It wasn't that long ago that we actually recalled the governor for the first time in the history of the state. And that happened right after we had elected him. And it didn't take that long to get a bunch of people motivated to say, I want to change. And so I think you're right. There is enough recognition of the nature of the challenge. What hasn't yet happened is, how can I do something about it that has a call to action associated with it that is as simple as recall the governor? Now, I'm not advocating for recalling the governor. I'm just advocating as an analogy to engage.
Okay, before
but
we go there,
just
we're going to be taking your questions pretty quick. So if you'd like to start lining up at the microphone, we'll be able to move right into that. Yeah, go ahead, Gene.
I just wanted to say, in terms of the recall of the governor, yes, it was a quick spark of change, but I looked at that as one of the more cynical sides of what happened. There was a lot of money thrown into that. All of a sudden, Darrell Issa and others decided, hey, this is something worth going for. And you just, once again, you put it in front of the people. You created what was kind of a media story about how bad Gray Davis was. And we had a circus. Really, we had a circus of candidates of who was running for governor. And we elected a Hollywood guy. And how much good did that do us?
Okay, we're going to be getting into the questions pretty quick, but I want to want to move down, quick answer, 30 seconds each. Melissa said that everything seems tied together. One reform leads to another or to another, and the problems are all linked. What has to be done first? And we'll start with Lenny. 30 seconds.
Oh, you're going to start with me. Well, I thought you were going to end with me.
No, you win this one too.
So what has to happen first? I think we have...
If you're going to reform, where do you have to start?
We have to start with a citizens' movement. We need to get... In 2012, we need to get 1 million citizens in the state to show up and demand reform at the ballot. We need to get them to engage, contribute, talk to their neighbors, and spark that movement. That's what I think is the biggest need.
Jaime?
Even though legislators probably have, I think, an 11% approval rating or somewhere around there, we have to actually trust them, and we have to give them the ability to change the system. We have to give them the ability to change the initiative system. I think that's what's gotten us in all this trouble to begin with. And until we actually allow those changes to happen at the legislative level, we're going to keep digging ourselves in these holes.
Melissa.
I think to both your points, we need to reignite the Constitutional Convention. I think in terms of what of each of these little components needs to be dealt with first, I think you have to crack it open and sort of get people educated, get a group of people together to really rewrite and propose significant total reform package to the Constitution.
Gabriel.
Okay, I've got a little change I think we could sneak through.
Okay.
Let's change the threshold for us to vote a tax on ourselves to 55% instead of 66 2/3, because a bunch of people will think we're raising it from 50 to 55, and we'll sneak it through that way.
Thank you. This is the time we get to, you get to ask the panel the questions and find out what they think, and we get to hear what you think. So if you'd come to the microphone and start, that'd be great. The only thing I'm going to ask is try and keep the questions tight. The shorter your questions, the more people get to ask them. Go ahead.
First of all, Inform is about young people, and they're very involved here, and they invite me. I feel like the godfather, but I come to every one of their meetings, and they have debates every 2 weeks on critical issues. These are smart young people. What do you think about having a grading system for your legislators and they're graded on their attendance records, on their voting records, and their qualifications? I think you have a lot of unqualified people in leadership positions in this state, and a lot of them are really ignorant.
I could not agree more.
You can
the
do
more
the
you
report
watch,
card.
The more depressing it is, frankly.
Maybe you need a grading system. These people are used to going to school.
Well, you know, you could grade attendance, and there's some things that are sort of objectively, quantifiable. But when it comes to what are their qualifications, that's very, very subjective. But I think you're right. I mean, we do need some better talent. I don't know how we'd go about, what organization, state funded probably, that would have to be set up to do the grading system. We'd probably create a whole other bureaucracy.
And it'd be the legislature that'd probably set it up.
Right, exactly. They'd appoint themselves or their former colleagues.
A plus is for everybody.
Yeah.
Next question, please.
Yes, I see on this pamphlet here this talk about responsive democracy. And yet in this state here right now, there's a legislation on board called the Dodd-Frank Reform Finance Bill. Section 342, authored by Maxine Waters, would set up a quota system, would overturn Proposition 209 effectively. It would establish 20 offices to impose hiring ratios for minorities. This may sound like a good deal, but it's against the Constitution, against all state law. How is this board going to talk about that?
I think the question is, to an extent, about quotas, right?
It's about the Dodd-Frank Bill, Section 342. It is a quota section, no question about it. It's been in the papers, but people hardly know it exists.
Okay, well, thank you. Anybody want to take that? Certainly, if you want to talk about quotas, you can talk about, in San Francisco, the whole local hire is essentially a quota system to an extent, saying that so many people for a San Francisco project have to be hired from San Francisco. How do you deal with questions like that? Are they valid?
Well, in San Francisco, for example, local hiring initiatives are the subject of a number of legal opinions, and courts have weighed in on them under various circumstances. Actually, the most recent one that was passed in San Francisco was very narrowly tailored to be lawful under prior legal precedent. And I assume that if this quota system is unconstitutional, assuming that is actually in the law, I'm not familiar with that section, that it will be duly addressed by the proper court.
Or it will be voted on again.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Next question, please.
I'm just kind of wondering what planet you guys live on that you don't notice that we have protests and around what's going on in this town every day, and there's lots of really engaged people, so maybe you should turn off Fox. But it's doesn't make a lot of difference, this last turnaround, like on the Board of Supervisors. The minute they got in, they got bought out, so we got the same people. There's so much dirt around elections. We have move forward in San Francisco. So now we do have touch screen machines, and Oakland got rid of theirs. We're spending tons of money on the prison system instead of senior lunches. I think it's all pretty clear. And we're not enforcing a whole lot of things like the corporate taxes. We don't have to make more taxes. We just have to enforce some of the ones going on. We had a guy whistleblow on, what was it, $1.4 million unpaid transfer tax, and the people who were supposed to have collected almost beat the guy up for doing it. It's really pretty sad.
Jamie, is there a difference between, certainly there's a lot of activism out there, and a lot of people are out there, as she said.
I'm still trying to figure out what planet I'm from, so go ahead, I'm thinking on that one.
Every day you see people out marching for one thing or another. But is there a difference between actually going out there and actually getting something done at the end of the day?
Look, I mean, I think that there is definitely most positive things start with some sort of grassroots movement where there's, you know, people, the people believe in what's happening, and there's a spark that gets started, and there's coalitions that are built. But also at the end of the day, I mean, frankly, we live in a system of incrementalism, and there is very little, you know, radical change that happens, you know, on a year-to-year or even a decade-by-decade basis. Things happen in small steps, and that's kind of the nature of the system. There, you know, this, you know, these folks think that you should preserve these historic buildings. These folks think that these historic buildings shouldn't stay there and you should build something new there. Let's fight over it. And then all of a sudden something happens that is kind of a compromise between the two. And that's just at a local level on one small local issue. So I do think that there's definitely always a need for people and a value for people to express their, you know, their political opinions and sometimes their political rage. But at the end of the day, I do think that we live in a system both at the state and at the federal level, and even in the city, that's always going to be a bit incremental in approach.
Next question then, please.
Hi. We talked a little bit about how there's this sort of disconnect between the sort of common person and our political leaders. I would say that for most people, government, and particularly the legislature, only exists in the abstract. Right? People don't know who their representative is, either in the state legislature, Congress, or even on the city council, in a lot of cases. And I personally think that the news media bears some blame for this, in the sense that it gets reported in the these things get reported in the abstract. You don't hear names of individual legislators being mentioned as often as I think they should be. Particular proposals or bills, ballot measures, those kinds of things there's a hesitance to get into the weeds and really talk about the substance. Is there a responsibility within the news media to change the way that they report on these sorts of things in order to help generate more inspiration to get involved and to generate this kind of a movement that Lenny's talking about?
John?
I think I'm going to get nailed with this one. I think one of the problems you have, especially when you're talking about the big media, mainstream media, is the area we're talking about. The Chronicle, for example, covers the nine Bay Area counties. It's hard to point to this legislator in San Francisco, this one up in Marin, and that one out in Sassoon City to say, okay, here's what they did. Having said that, though, I think it's important to, you know, give people an idea of how they're being represented, you know, to say what their representatives are doing. In the Bay Area, you know, if you're a Republican, you are not going to find any Republican legislators. There just aren't any. And that's the problem in a lot of the state, is that it's pretty much set, you know, for whatever reason, not gerrymandered necessarily, but just by where people live and, you know, who they live with. I think that one interesting thing, again, if you look at polls, people that hate the legislature have a tendency to like their own legislator. My guy is great. It's all those other guys that are causing the problem. And I think you need to come up with a thing of saying, okay, ask them the questions. The good thing is assemblymen and congressmen have to run every 2 years. Unfortunately, they, in California at least, most of them take it as just kind of a coronation rather than an election. And I think that that's what a lot of people that voted for the change in redistricting and everything hope will end. Anybody else want to touch on that?
Just jump in here real fast. First of all, www.thesweetmelissa.com. Because we get into the weeds. But understand, too, I mean, when you write for the paper or even on, you know, on a blog or for whatever the outlet is, I mean, you're writing for an audience, right? And it only takes, you know, a cursory look at the sort of opening page on SF Gates to look, you know, most viewed articles. What are they? Reese Witherspoon breaks up with Jake Gyllenhaal.
It ain't,
guess what? I know, oh my God. It ain't, let's talk about Prop 1A. You know what I mean? So to some degree, I mean, the readers, if there was a reader interest, one would think that there, you know, there is somewhat a symbiotic relationship. If there was reader interest, there might be more people willing to write about it and more newspapers and other outlets catering to that. But it is the fault of, I think maybe both parties on that. And that people, you know, again, would rather read about, you know, the Kardashians, then you can't blame them, but then the state legislature. And so it's hard to point the finger strictly at the newspaper and say, why aren't you writing more boring stuff that people don't want to read?
I would also observe that the news media as we have known it for the last 50 years is dying. So I guess new things are emerging that will replace them. Like Melissa's website, but you know, it's a time when all of that is going to change. I don't think it's going to change in a way that's probably going to be good for the things you care about, though, in terms of lots of people getting exposed to the inner workings of our democracy.
Just need a reality TV show from Sacramento, the real legislators of downtown Sacramento.
The real legislators of Sacramento. I like it. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
Thank you. For full disclosure, I worked on the Constitutional Convention campaign for 3 weeks, and I'm an organizer by trade. My question changed a little bit, considering some of the responses just given. But will reform through the ballot initiative process or incrementalism be too slow? And what can we do to spark that revival in this systemic kind of structural change this far out? Because right now, the way I feel, the Constitutional Convention broke for reasons that seemed beyond, at least mine, as a voter's control. So, thank you.
Lenny, why don't you take a shot at that?
So I think three things. We need to try all avenues. So we need to keep pushing for change that can happen in the legislature. We need to keep pushing for individual change if there are initiatives that make sense, like redistricting. And then we need, most importantly, as I said, which is why I led with it, I think we need to create the movement that insists on the change that we're talking about. And the Constitutional Convention, if we had to do it over again, wouldn't have started with gathering signatures. It would have started with creating that movement so that there were a million members, so when they showed up, they were all signing the ballots and got one friend, and then it would have been on the ballot. So that's why I think the most important thing is to start with creating the movement so you get that enthusiasm there. And I think we need to try all the things in the meantime, get the legislature and the governor and force them to make stuff happen. I think we need to, if appropriate initiatives come in or part of that process happen. And then if all that doesn't work, I think we still need to hold open the option of much more radical change, including resuscitating the Constitutional Convention idea if this doesn't get fixed very quickly.
So anybody else want to?
Yeah, building on what Lenny said, I agree with all of that. You know, one thing I've learned about social change is it's opportunistic. You have your agenda of all the things you want to get done, and you're hopefully building power, or you're building your movement. But, you know, the polls show that the percentage of Americans that believe climate change is a serious problem just depends on how hot the weather is that month. And so we got to get our bill ready and then pick a really hot summer in Washington, and then all of a sudden we'll be able to get it through. And I think that's true for so many of the changes, that it's going to be unpredictable when we get our moment, but we need to be ready for it.
Well, and that's, you know, it was a number of years back when they had the Constitutional Revision Commission. When they put the commission, started them, the state was totally in the tank, in the dumper, and it was a disaster, so let's fix something. However, by the time the group got done and brought their recommendations up, things were looking better. And the legislature said, again, thank you very much for all your time, and nothing was ever done.
Or worse. I mean, sort of the flip side of that is, you know, if it takes too long, then people, like Prop 13, you know, there were years of people saying, hey, our property tax is way too high, you guys need to do something. And then, you know, everybody, you know, the legislature dragged its feet, and the next thing you know, we have Prop 13 is sort of a backlash, an extreme measure, because people don't feel like their needs are being taken into consideration. So on some level, if, you know, incrementalism, yes, but at some point, if you wait too long, people will just kind of freak out, and Lord knows what. You know, if it's a hot day, and you know, maybe it's not an organization as nice as Spur that's waiting, you know, sitting there with a really radical proposal out there. Maybe it's a radical proposal that does something really horrible.
You know, maybe
it's
just a cold, foggy day.
We got a lot of those.
We still have some time for questions, so if more people would like to line up, that's fine. Go ahead now.
Yeah, I think we have to return to media, because although there need to be reforms in the ballot initiative system and other parts of government, the political reporting is just as broken as state government is. And one of the big problems you have is just the total focus, well, not completely total, but intense focus on horse race coverage. And when you have, you know, 10 or 12 ballot initiatives on the state or city level, most of those don't get the coverage that they need. So, you know, part of the reason you have, you know, sometimes contradictory results, you know, like we had with the last, where there was some tax thresholds raised and some lowered, is those initiatives didn't get much coverage. It's like they seized on a couple of initiatives that were covered fairly well, and then the rest fall by the wayside. And so I think, you know, some of that can be addressed by new media. But the reality is people still get a lot of their coverage from TV, and TV is the worst example. A lot of the TV stations no longer have Sacramento reporters and also newspapers. So we need some real pressure on the media to do better coverage.
Okay, spur.org for the voter guide before every election.
It's really quite good. So let me add to the list of potential reforms to the initiative process, maybe a limit on the total number of initiatives on any given ballot, so that people do have the time to devote to each individual proposal.
Well, that's an important concern, too, because if there's too much out there, too many things clamoring for the attention of, you know, both the media and not only that, the voters, it's as good as having nothing out there. Because if they spread it, they say, well, I don't understand all of these. There's nothing to focus on. And I guess that's, you know, important consideration for, you know, any reform group, to not try and put too much out there, to make sure that you only put enough that people can grab and grasp, right?
Yeah, I mean, part of the challenge is that there is limited attention, whether it's individual voters, citizens more broadly, or the media. So you can't have everything happen at once. The countervailing to that is that, as Melissa said, these are so intertwined that we've basically handicapped all of our legislators into a linear program with too many constraints, or you've got Houdini with too many locks and he can't get out before he drowns. And so we have to find some way to unleash all those things. And I hope we can do it by thoughtfully taking components out one by one, but ultimately we may have to do something more integrated that enables people to have a more substantial rethinking of the whole system, because as it works today, it's not working and it's not getting better fast enough.
We got time for one more question if there's anybody out there. Someone who hasn't spoken before. Come on up.
You brought up earlier the things with social media, and so that was one of the things I know down at Stanford. I heard how successful that was in this past even presidential campaign. What are some of the more successful integrations of that have you seen to raise people's awareness now to some of the more local things? For example, as silly as it is, the Beta Breakers. You know, when that was going to be canceled, people created a Facebook group, no overhead there to do that. And then you had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who all they had to do was like something, and then on it goes again. So what? What are some of the campaigns you've seen?
Melissa, I think you're our social media maven, aren't you?
Oh, Lord, maven already. Well, so, yeah, you point out beta breakers. I mean, the, you know, that led to the, you know, porta potty gate and a lot of the reforms that, that resulted. But, you know, I will say this, you know, in terms of social media, I mean, one of the issues that, that Jaime brought up earlier is, you know, you can get the word out this way, and that's okay. But you have to, you know, it should take more than just liking something. You know, does it make you an activist to say, I've done my civic duty today. I like freedom in Tunisia already. I pat myself on the back. I'm practically in the Peace Corps.
Where's my sandwich?
You know, I can feel really good about myself. You know, it does take some more than that. And what I'm concerned about is that social media is allowing people to feel like they've accomplished something when they really haven't. And so, you know, I would just put that out there, you know, sort of as a caution. However, to your actual question, what are some of the better campaigns? Well, you know, I think Joanna Reese has done a good job of building some good online support for her mayoral campaign. You can see vast differences in how each of the actual candidates for office sort of treat social media and how comfortable they are with it. Gavin Newsom, of course, did a great job of galvanizing support. You know, they didn't exactly translate into voters. But, you know, what the heck. That was another campaign that I thought was very, you know, again, at least from an online perspective, was really successful.
Yeah, actually, a quick campaign that we actually helped to work on was a reaction to Fiona Ma introduced legislation to limit electronic dance parties in public facilities and in larger facilities, and we actually worked with a number of venue operators, and the organization started a Facebook page, and they called it Save the Rave, and they were able to get, you know, thousands and thousands of people kind of through their networks onto the Facebook page, who then responded and just clicked one thing and sent something to the assemblywoman, and before you knew it, there was a real backlash against it, and she came back and then started meeting with a lot of these groups, and she modified the legislation, and now it's probably a lot better or a lot more scaled back, whereas before, and that was something, talking about tapping into the youth, you tapped into their spirit of free expression and wanting to be able to congregate, and they were enlivened. So
I'd just say, in addition to looking at things that have worked here, I would say watch this space. I mean, we are at the early days of what's possible with these technologies. So as an example, if you want a disruptive technology, that the technology is there, it's getting our laws to be aligned with it, is signature gathering by electronically, by your iPhone or your iPad or your mobile phone, to be able to sign a signature. Now, that would be extremely disruptive. It would enable anybody who get a movement to put something on the ballot. The first order effect of that would be terrible. The second order of the fact would be pretty interesting. It actually forced a lot of the changes potentially around what we need to do to revive change the initiative process. Well, that technology already exists. It's been challenged in court and said it's not legal because you have to have a physical signature on a piece of paper. Well, it turns out if you look at the history, that was true for campaign contributions at one time, that you couldn't make campaign contributions electronically because it was illegal, because you had to certify that you were a person by physically signing it. The court case was actually that enabled that was that went back to saying a telegraph is signature gathering. And so if you're pressing a button, that is legally the same as signing something on a piece of paper. And so electronic contributions to campaigns were legal. So, I mean, I don't say those are at the specifics as much as an example of watch that we're only beginning the application of a lot of these technologies to altering the political landscape. And it leaves me excited about the possibility for disruptive applications.
Okay. I got one question. This one comes from me to the panel. Give me about 30 seconds each. Gabriel, Jaime, Melissa, and Lenny, what are your 60-second ideas to change the world? And we'll start at the opposite end with Gabriel. 30 seconds. 30 seconds, not 60 seconds.
I have so many.
The clock's moving, Gabriel.
Okay, so I'm thinking a lot about war, about how much of our taxes go to war. How about at the national level, just this little change, that before Congress authorizes a war, they have to estimate how much it will cost?
Okay. Melissa?
Similarly, everyone should have to eat my dad's biscuits and tomato gravy.
Maybe if Maybe if
you got some of Melissa's time here, Jamie.
Maybe if everyone around the world was just forced to sit quietly for 30 seconds like I'm about to, all at once, something good would happen.
Lenny.
More Commonwealth Club conversations, but that have the wine before the session, not after the session.
Let's give a big round of applause to our panel for sharing their thoughts with us tonight. Now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.